Why choose a Sleep Number smart bed?
Can I make my side softer?
Can I make my side firmer?
Can we sleep cooler?
Sleep Number does that. Cools up to 8 times faster and lets you choose your ideal comfort on either side. Your Sleep Number setting. It's the Sleep Number Everything Smart Bed Sale. Every smart bed and base are on sale during our Memorial Day event. Up to 50% off, plus free home delivery. Limited time. Exclusively the Sleep Number store near you. Learn more at sleepnumber.com.
Hey folks, Nicole here. We usually leave it to Mark to record these preambles, but I've noticed he's been mildly abusing this power. This is what happens when you record a whole season of content ahead of time. The two of us had such a blast recording season one of Nevermind the Music, and we're gearing up for season two. Subscribe to our show, and hey, maybe you even have an elder millennial nerd in your life that loves music composition and psychology as much as us. Share a favorite episode with them and help us spread the word. Also, feel free to rate and review this podcast or certain episodes so we know what you'd like to hear more of in the future. Look at me using my preamble power for good. $20, says Mark's going to chime in here and tell you that you have to rate and review us. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Here is Johnny B. Good by...
Michael J. Fox.
Michael J. Fox, that's right. Do you remember? So, Wendy, thank you so much. Who does he call up and he says, oh, I'm going to tell my cousin...
Yeah, not Marvin Gaye or whoever.
Who's the black man that rips off that poor white boy?
Right.
Chuck Berry, right?
Tale.
Hi, I'm Mark.
And I'm Nicole, and this is Nevermind the Music. What are we talking about today, Mark?
The Doobie Brothers. Long Train Running. Remember this song?
Of course I remember that song. It's amazing. The Doobie Brothers are timeless.
So this is from 1973, their album The Captain and Me. I would say there is a timelessness to them. I agree with that. And I think part of that might have to do with the fact that it kind of feels like there's multiple different Doobie Brothers. Not Brothers Doobie, but versions of the band. But we can come to that. This is their third album. This is also, does this feel right? It feels like one of their biggest hits, right?
To be honest, a lot of the Doobie Brothers songs sound similar to me.
Especially this generation of them, maybe.
Yes.
But this one hit number 8.
Great.
But they have two number ones, Blackwater.
Okay.
And What a Fool Believes.
What a Fool Believes is a great song.
It is a great song.
Sounds just like this.
What a Fool Believes sounds completely different from this. So okay. Fundamentally. Can we come back to What a Fool Believes?
Yes.
I want to talk about it in a little bit. So,
okay.
Real Love hit number 5. But other than that... And that one's later. Other than that, this is their third biggest hit. Written by their vocalist and guitarist, Tom Johnston. Yeah, so...
They're not Doobies? It's not Tom Doobie?
So, yeah, okay, so let's talk about this. Is there a more, like, audacious and ballsy, for lack of a better term, name than calling your band the Doobie Brothers?
Is it about weed?
It's definitely about weed.
Oh.
Of course it's about weed.
I thought they were, like, Tom Doobie and, like, Charles Doobie.
Like the Everly Brothers or whatever?
Yeah, exactly.
No, this is a... So I looked into this trying to figure out what's the deal with that name, because this seems like a joke name that someone I was in a college band would have...
Let's call ourselves the Doobie Brothers.
Right. Haha. That is what it is.
Oh, cool.
Like a roommate of one of them said, well, you guys smoke a lot of pot. Why don't you call yourself the Doobie Brothers? And it was a placeholder name as they had their first gig to like decide what their actual real name would be. Which is wild to me, because then it stuck. It's one of those things that, you know, when the Beach Boys were 30, they kind of chafed against the name The Beach Boys, right? They kind of regretted it. I wonder, did the Doobie Brothers, when they had number one hits 5 years later or whatever, you know, it's still the 1970s America, right? It's not 2024, 2025 or whenever this episode drops. But yeah, listeners, still not sure which episode number this will be. We don't know. But, it's quite a thing, especially for like a pop group. They're fun. They're a rock band. They're all these things. But fundamentally, that's pop music,
yeah.
Right? Accessible. To call yourselves that. I don't know. I feel like that's really audacious.
Can like you kind think of like taboo kind of?
Yeah. Like talk about a way to make all the parents of that era hate you.
And all the right? kids love you.
I guess that's it. And all the kids love you. But even then, this is music that I feel like Squares would like. and the Squares in the 70s, maybe. Anyways, one of the weird things about this band, one of the cool things about this band is just how many people there are. The band at this point had 7 people in it. And this isn't like a band with a horn section or anything. That's 2 drummers. The 2 drummer thing is wild. That's very of an era, right?
Sure.
Like the Allman Brothers have it. Nowadays, use some bands, you know, like King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard or whatever.
That's a great band name.
It's a good band, too. Mm-hmm. They have 2 drummers sometimes. Cool. But, you know, in this song, we'll hear that there aren't 2 drum sets. It's more like one guy's doing hand percussion and things like that. And
imagine if it was like 2 brothers playing on the same drum set together. That'd be really sweet.
Like piano forehands where there's 2 people sitting at the piano.
I'd really like that. The Doobie Brothers.
That would be
so
really hard to do, to have 2 people at the same drum set.
Like one playing the the foot drums and one playing the hand drums.
It's a lot harder to coordinate 2 central nervous systems than it is 1.
Impossible,
but,
even.
But yeah, there is nobody with the, this is not the Bee Gees where there's the Brothers Gibb. This is not.
Is that why they're called the Bee Gees?
The Brothers Gibb. Yeah. The Robin, Maurice, and Barry. Yeah, they're
How
all
do you
brothers.
Know that? How do you
I
know that? That?
Well, maybe we need to do a Bee Gees episode. Bee Gees, of course. We got to know the Bee Gees. This is not Van Halen, where there's 2 Van Halen brothers and then the rest of the band coalescing around them. This is just about weed. You're gonna have to. You're gonna have to deal with it. But anyways, back to the variety of people in this band. I checked it out. 14 different total members in this band. So there's a lot of turnover, and that doesn't even count the touring members and the studio musicians and stuff. But what I want to talk about before we jump into the actual song, remember everybody, we're talking about Long Train Running, is bands that have a lead vocalist change.
Okay.
Like this band has always had, you know, there'd be the one song on the album that the lead guitar player sings or the bass player sings, that kind of thing. But they've kind of had, Tom Johnston was kind of their guy. And he was in the band until 77, and then he left because of stomach ulcer problems.
Oh, gosh.
And then he came back again in the late 80s and kind of stayed with the band. But this is what things sound like with him on vocals. And you're right, maybe this sounds sort of similar to Long Train Running. This is Listen to the Music, their hit from 1972. Yeah, so kind of that like poppy but Southern rock kind of sound, a little country Southern rock despite being from San Jose, California, that kind of a thing. And then he starts having health problems. Do you know who they bring in to fill in?
Tom Doobie.
No, Tom Doobie's not there. Michael McDonald.
Yes, I knew that Michael McDonald worked in somewhere here. I'm a big Michael McDonald
blue-eyed
fan.
Soul singer. So
handsome.
So handsome, too.
I think.
He's
I don't
a silver know. Fox now. Have you seen? There's still videos of him. He still sounds great.
No, I'm familiar.
So then they started sounding like this. This is Minute by Minute from 1978.
Michael McDonald always sounds like he has a mouthful of mashed potatoes or something.
Right. A beautiful tasting mashed potatoes. Like, but you so cannot smooth. Tell me that sounds the same.
It doesn't. I like the first one better.
You like, okay, so you like
the classic.
The classic sound. I'm not surprised by that because I know you're into some jangly country influenced, folky
kind of,
influenced music. And I think that fits. Clearly they're different. And they had hits in both versions, right? And that's what's rare. And I think before we jump into the music specifically, like, what other bands can say that? That they, obviously bands have, you know, there's a new singer of Queen or whatever.
Yeah.
Queen has their era where they had their hits.
Mm-hmm.
And that was all Freddie Mercury.
Van Halen.
Van Halen,
yeah,
right?
That's the only one I can really think of.
They really have 2. I mean, I know they have multiple more lead singers than 2 because like Gary Cherone from Extreme was there. Noted Boston hair metal band Extreme. But David Lee Roth and Sammy Hagar both had fame and fortune as the vocalist.
Sammy Hagar's way better.
That is going to cause a lot of, I actually, to be honest, do not have a,
you have no opinion.
I think I like the music from the David Lee Roth era more, but I don't necessarily like him more. I think that's controversial.
I think that I feel the same way. I like the music more from the David Lee Roth era, but I just don't like him. I just, something about him I just don't like, man.
David, write in.
Write in. Is he alive?
Commit
still?
Us. Yeah,
probably.
I'll cut that out if I'm wrong, but yeah.
Let us know.
I've never heard
David Lee
Roth is alive. He's doing his own thing. Yeah, Genesis, another?
Phil Collins.
But Peter Gabriel before that.
I love but Peter I think Gabriel.
I actually think maybe they had more hits under Phil Collins, but that Peter Gabriel kind of blew up. So I don't know.
I mean, like Simon and Garfunkel, too. You never hear of Garfunkel.
But Simon and Garfunkel as a band did not change lead singers.
No.
They didn't, they it didn't like... become Simon and Garfunkel, but Bob Dylan was Garfunkel. No, it stayed Simon and Garfunkel.
The band, and then, right? The band changed singers, probably. They had a bunch of different people.
We talked about the band another episode, and there was some confusion by me about that. So it feels like a lot of metal. AC/DC, you know, they've got Bon Scott, and then Brian, so like TNT, and then Brian Johnson, Back in Black, right?
Sure.
Black Sabbath also, Ozzy Osbourne, and then Ronnie James Dio and Ian Gillan and all these other. But I think the reason why it might be more common in those bands is those are like guitar god bands.
Sure.
Right? You've got Eddie Van Halen. You've got, what is it, Angus Young and AC/DC. You've got the sort of heart of the band is not the singer anyways.
Yeah.
Whereas a band like this that's more like pop songs, it seems like...
Like the vibe is so different. Well, the vibe's the same, but tonality is
very
different.
If you pick any band and you add Michael McDonald, your sound is super different. He's also a keyboardist, so he's playing this like super jazzy stuff instead. But
he's funny. He's just so funny to me. His voice like makes me laugh and smile every time.
You like the more Southern rock, less the soul pop era.
I do. I feel like when Michael McDonald started singing for the Doobie Brothers, it became in my head, and this might be controversial, like the Michael McDonald Show, because his voice is so distinct to me that it's all I can hear. I have a hard time saying like, okay, that's the Doobie Brothers, because in my head, I'm like, that's Michael McDonald. It's so iconic to me.
Totally. Noted. So should we get back to Long Train Running?
Let's do it.
So I actually wanted to talk about one chord, just one chord in this song, but that chord gives so much weight and so much oomph.
Is it A major?
It is not A major.
Should I
tell you what it is?
Can I keep guessing? How many steps away from?
Not many. You are not close in affect. You are close in pitch name.
G?
G what, Nicole?
G sharp? Major?
G major?
G minor. Oh, I would have gotten there.
I want to talk about a G minor chord with a D in the bass. Why do I care about that? We're going to get back to this. But this one chord gives us a lot of gravity in this song. So let's start at the beginning. This song is in the key of G minor, and you're going to know that because you're going to hear a lot of G minor. Listen to the intro. It's very cool little guitar, strummy strum riff.
Mm-hmm. Baseline of the song is so fun.
Baseline super fun. There's that cool acoustic the acoustic riff, but that was one chord. Yeah, there's a little noodling around, but it's just G minor 7. Just G minor 7. It sits there the whole time. It's got cool percussion. It's got good bass. Like we said, there's a lot to keep it interesting, but what is not interesting is the chord progression. There is no chord progression, right? It is what we would call harmonic stasis. It is harmonically static, right? All G minor, or specifically G minor 7. Try to feel as we listen to the other parts of the song, like there's this weight always back to that G minor. That G minor feels like home. Do you remember from other podcasts we've recorded what the name for home is in a key?
3 or the root?
No, like what the... Okay, root is good. Root is actually... This is confusing to even music majors sometimes. The root is the home name of a chord.
Okay.
So like a G minor chord, what's the root?
G.
G, right? Yeah. The root of a C sharp chord is C sharp, right? The home of the key is called the tonic.
Oh, right. You told me that before.
Like gin and tonic, right? The tone, the home tone of the key.
Like when I listen to the Doobie Brothers, it makes me want to drink a gin and tonic sometimes.
That's correct. The tonic is what we call the home bass. So the G chord is our tonic. So we hear a lot of that.
Member Week is here at Lowe's. Don't miss your chance to get up to 40% off hundreds of items like paint, stain, tools, flooring, and more. Shop our exclusive deals happening in-store and online from May 8th through May 14th. Not a member? Join My Lowe's Pro Rewards for free today and get ready to save more. Lowe's, we help you save. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
And so let's listen to a bit of the start of the verse section, and you're going to finally hear the chord change. Down around the corner, half a mile from here, see them all be running, and watch them disappear. Without love, where would you be now? So when he goes to the word without love, we go to a new chord. Do you want to guess, or should I just tell you?
Let me hear it again. That's gonna matter.
I'm gonna play you just the chords.
Okay, cool. Yeah, play me just the chords. G.
Without love, it goes to that higher chord.
Higher than G would be A.
A is higher than G. This is a C minor chord.
I was gonna say C because that's the steps.
So G, A, B flat in this key,
yeah,
C. So this is number four in this key. Okay. We call that the four chord. So this move,
what? You're talking to me like I'm 2 years old. We call that the four chord. He's holding up four fingers.
Oh,
and
I was holding up, listeners. I was holding up in case she couldn't follow.
Four.
All right. So this move going from one to four and back to one, because okay, that's what it does. Where would you be now? He goes back to one. That's super common. This comes from the blues. Have you ever heard anybody mention 12 bar blues?
No.
12 bar blues. Anybody who like took two guitar lessons in the 1970s or whatever, you probably had to learn 12 bar blues at some point, right? 12 bar blues is a form, a structure, essentially a pattern of chords that is used in a lot of blues music. And because it's used in a lot of blues music, it's used in a lot of R&B and rock and roll and stuff like that. So what it is, basically, this started 100 years ago or more, right, with original blues music. It's basically a sequence. You go one and then you go up to four, then you go back to one and then you go five. And so like there's a pattern that's 12 measures long. That's why it's called 12 bar blues. And it just becomes sort of the staple of a lot of popular music, especially in the like starting in the 40s going into the 60s. So here is Johnny B. Goode by
Michael J. Fox.
Michael J. Fox. That's right. Do you remember? So when he, thank you so much. Who does he call up and he says, oh, I'm going to tell my cousin.
Yeah, not Marvin Gaye or whoever.
Who's the black man that rips off that poor white boy?
Right.
Chuck Berry, right?
Tale.
Yeah. The classic tale as old as time of cultural appropriation against the white teenagers from the 80s going back to the 50s. 1958, Johnny B. Goode.
This is your cousin, Marvin Berry. That's what he says.
Yeah. Exactly right.
So good.
So Johnny B. Goode, 1958, rock and roll. This is a 12-bar blues. You're going to hear that same move, 1-4 back to 1. Deep down in Louisiana, close to New Orleans, way back up in the woods among the evergreens, there stood a log cabin made of earth and wood, where lived a country boy named Johnny B. Goode, who never ever learned to read or write so well, but he could play a guitar just like a ringing a bell. Go, go! So that's the whole 12-bar blues form. Now, here's a slower example that'll give us a little more, something a little closer to this groove. This is 1967, Soul Brothers 6 with the song Some Kind of Wonderful.
I love that song.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah.
This song starts out with a lot of G and then moving back and forth between one and four and one in a way that is reminiscent of the blues, though it doesn't finish like a 12-bar blues would. What we finally get when we get to the hook of the song at the end of the refrain, it's not the blues. We get this six chord. Take a listen here. So nobody cares, but we get E flat.
I knew it was going to be E. I was going to say that.
Yeah,
because you're coming up from
G.
That's
right. That's right. Yes. Thank you. Good job. G, A, B flat in this key. C, D, E flat in this key. Good job, Nicole.
I was going to interrupt you, but I was like,
yeah, no. You were there. You were right there. So it starts E flat, then it passes through a G chord, and then it hits a D chord, which is the five, number five. We've talked about five in other podcasts. We talked about it in our Everybody Talks podcast. Some other ones, we've talked about it as a chord that kind of like,
D is like meh.
Well,
kind of like a meh note, right?
Sorry. D is whatever you want D to be, but five in a key means something. Like D doesn't, this is actually an interesting diversion that we don't need to take, but I'll just mention a chord doesn't necessarily, like if I go to the piano and play a D chord right now, it doesn't have any meaning.
Sure. It needs context.
Is it the, exactly. Is that D the one of a key of D, or is it like it is in this case, the five in the key of G minor? The five in the key of G minor means something totally different than the one in the key of D major. In the modern era, there's no chord has meaning. It's just has meaning when it's in a key. So listen here how that, when they're doing the three-part harmony on Without Love, you're going to hear that last chord is this D, and that is impactfully pointing us back towards our home base of G. That's what the D does. Five wants to go back to one. Listen. Cool. So just with the piano, here's D going to G minor. Sounds okay, right?
Yeah, sounds sadder than this song sounds.
Interesting. To me, I hear a huge release of energy here. Just listen. Without love. And when we hear that with the vocals, it sounds like it has arrived somewhere when we finish it. And then the groove can continue again.
So good.
All right.
I'm really interested in this idea of notes in context.
Oh.
I'm like stuck on that. And it's like really referencing a lot of psychological stuff for me in terms of like how memories are processed and how memories in context matter. And I'm like kind of spinning around that in my head as you're talking about all this stuff.
So this is really interesting because what I'm about to talk about is not even... I haven't even told you the chord that I'm talking about, but the point we're going to get into is how we're about to hear there's a G chord, mm-hmm. another G chord, right? G chord is just one, right?
Spoilers. There's a G chord
there's
coming
a G chord.
Up.
That's right. And we've heard nothing but G.
Yeah.
But the way this G is used is totally different. And it doesn't mean the same thing as the G we've heard for the entire song. So the context completely changes.
Even though standalone note is the same.
That's
the
exactly right. So go ahead with what you're saying. But I'm just saying that you're actually unknowingly kind of working with what I'm about to go into.
I'm
so thank you very much.
Super duper smart. That's right. It's fine. Yeah, I'm thinking about like memories in general. And I know we talked a lot about memories in another podcast, but we didn't talk about something called a flashbulb memory. Do you know what a flashbulb memory is?
No, is it like, am I guessing? No, I do not know what it is.
Let me ask you a question I ask my students, which is important to the understanding.
That's right.
Do you know what a flashbulb is?
A flashbulb is something that old-timey photographs would have, and it would like take a long time to heat up. And mm-hmm. then it would boom pop. And you would time taking the photograph exactly at the right time, right?
Yes. So
I'm right that it's old timey photos. It's not just a flash on a camera. It's flash that was like a special device.
It was just like a pop of brightness that like allowed you to capture an image.
Sure.
Right. That you would need to capture that image.
Oh, they needed it. It wasn't just for dark. It was they always needed
it. They kind of always needed it because there were no overhead. I don't know. Whatever. It was old timey.
Losers.
Get electricity. But a lot of times I explain this to
Nicole, they did. They got electricity. They did it.
But you know what? Good for them. Way to go. Way to go, losers. Well, a lot of my students don't know what a flashbulb is, and that kind of ruins the whole metaphor of flashbulb memories. So we've decided in my classes to call them screenshot memories because it's easier for this generation to understand. So a flashbulb memory is a vivid memory that's highly detailed, that's attached to an emotional event that is either something that's very unique and personal to you or that we've experienced collectively.
Hmm.
Can you think of a memory that me and you have experienced collectively that you'll kind of always remember, like a cultural moment that you'll never forget, that I experienced that moment too, but maybe in different context than you?
Are we looking for fun or are we looking for heavy?
Usually they're heavier, but if it's fun,
that's so
great.
For me, West Coast, waking up at whatever age, a late teen, early college student would wake up and someone in one of my roommates had the TV on and it was 9/11 had just happened.
Sure.
So that would be that I would think, I remember that moment vividly.
Yes. Yeah. And I do too. Right. And I remember being in Boston at that moment and I was a sophomore in college, going to class. And I remember the class I was in, the room I was in, the tone of the teacher. I remember evacuating the city and going home on the train that day and having it be so weird.
Yeah.
So context matters, right? where you were at that specific moment impacts your memory, but we share that memory. It's kind of universal for us. Yeah. And I'll make the argument just like this D chord is universal, but it time and place matters for it, right? And how sure. you interpret it.
Yeah.
So flashbulb memories are often really vivid, often very personal. They last a really long time, and we do kind of share them collectively. But that only works for our generation. Like, you ask your students, they weren't born on 9/11, right?
Right.
They weren't born for the JFK shooting. They weren't born for the moon landing or any of that stuff.
Losers.
Right? Grow up. What do you think your students' generational, like, flashbulb memory cultural context would be? What do you think it is for them?
So I wonder, so my students, of course, are young adults. They're not kids. I wonder if COVID will have a few of those, but COVID was like this slow, dreadful, like drawing out of information. There was no moment when there was the moment when school shut down and a moment when work closed and all that. But I don't know that there was I can't pinpoint a specific moment, even though that feels like the generational event of our
It's interesting what you're saying. A lot of them do report that, like, they'll say like March 15th, 2020, because that was around the time that
sometime
things
in that
closed,
week or the
like
week
March
before,
12th.
Yeah.
But there's also a reason that you don't remember it vividly, and how a reason that COVID for all of us feels like this just like dip in the calendar, right? That it just happened and it was just this mess of time that even now you look back and you're like, oh, how is it 2024
right.
as time of recording now? Like, how?
When I say something happened 2 years ago and then I find out that it was 2019 or
because
whatever.
Because that was trauma for us.
Right.
Right. That was a collective trauma that everyone experienced, and our brains are protecting us from reliving that trauma by clouding the memory of it.
So
we don't
not
have
a flashbulb
to relive it.
Memory.
It's not a flashbulb
that's
memory.
That's really interesting. And I think some people maybe do have flashbulb memories. I think people who maybe lived in New York City probably do.
And the thing about flashbulb memories that is interesting is that they're incredibly easy to manipulate in people.
Mm.
Like there's been a lot of studies. There's one done by Elizabeth Loftus about long-term memory. She has a great TED talk about it as well. How you can, for sure, implant memories in people. Like, for sure, that's very easy to do. But especially around flashbulb memories, because they are really highly emotional, it's very easy to manipulate them.
Huh.
Especially around 9/11, there were some studies that done that said, you know, we can change how you contextualize that memory. If we show you a lot of news footage, you might think that you saw things from a certain point of view, but it's really just the news was showing it to you from that point of view. And what if the news is fake? Then, like, that's a whole other thing.
I mean, we talked about this a few podcasts ago. I don't remember which exact one, but you mentioned the Challenger explosion.
Yeah.
And you and I are about the same age. And I even looked up the date.
There's no way you could have remembered it.
You were not old enough to be in actual school, but you had a vivid memory of watching it in school. And maybe you watched it in preschool or something, but maybe you just heard so many stories of older cousins or whatever.
Yeah.
Because I know I heard stories from my older brother watching Challenger explosion. And so I have a vivid mental image, even though I was not there.
Yeah.
And that was not somebody deliberately manipulating you into that memory. That was accidental because it's a flashbulb moment for the culture.
Yeah.
Like, it's, you know, in the same way that
people
claim they were at Woodstock, like the number of people who claim they were in attendance at Woodstock is like many times more than were in attendance at Woodstock. It's impossible.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those people are just lying. Some of those people might actually in some weird way kind of remember that they were there 60 years ago. Right.
Yeah. Memory is not static, right?
It's not a recording.
It's not a recording. You access memories in present time. It's like there's like a little man in your brain today that's going back and looking through files of what happened yesterday, right? Or happened 10 years ago. And you remember it with today's lens. You look back and you remember it with today's lens.
Right.
And that can impact your memory. And then there are certain flashbulb memories that like are hard to manipulate because they did only happen to me. Like I remember very distinctly my daughter being born, like a lot of very, very distinct memories around that moment. No one can get in there. Like the news isn't going to come and run a broadcast that's going to like change my memory of my daughter.
That's right.
Joining the world. Right.
Yeah.
So it's just really interesting how context matters. And when you're talking about keys and notes and how they do just stand alone, like you could see an image of the World Trade Center getting hit by the planes, which is a scary image to see if you have memories attached to it. But if you are an alien from outer space and you just see that image, it doesn't mean anything to you. It's just an image. So if you hear a note, it's just a note. You need it in context. When I hear this song, I think of the note in context, but I also think of seeing my friend's cover band play this song because I attach those memories to this note in this chord as part of this composition. I think that's really awesome.
Taking a dramatic opposite, you've got a dog, right?
I do.
Your dog, in all measurable ways, has hearing that is so, so much better than yours.
Yeah.
Your dog probably can make no sense out of this random gibberish I'm playing when I play this song, right? Because that context and meaning means nothing to your dog, right? Right? Even though your dog is more acutely sensitive, just doesn't have any of the cultural sort of intellectual.
He doesn't have context. He doesn't have context for it. Yeah. No, my dog only wants one thing, and that's just to be a good boy.
To be a good boy. The bestest boy.
He just wants to be the best boy. And he is.
The goodest boy? Is it the goodest or the bestest?
He's the bestest boy.
Okay. I don't want to talk about the D. We heard that the D wants to go. Nicole, grow up. Grow up, but don't grow up a little bit because you keep this podcast from being too dry. Okay.
That's
listen
true.
To this. The D is the last chord on the word love before it goes back to the G minor. So at the risk of being overly pedantic, I want to talk about the chord before the D, because the D really wants to go to the G, but there's this chord before that that really wants to go to the D. Here's our E flat, this weird chord, D, G minor.
Mm.
So that chord is called the cadential 6-4.
Okay.
It has a name, but that's not the name of the chord. The chord is G minor second inversion. But the meaning of the chord, the context tells us that chord functions as...
Can you say it again?
The cadential 6-4. I will explain most of that. So in the same way that the word run,
mm-hmm.
What part of speech is that? Well, it's a verb, right? I will run. But
be
it's also,
noun,
I went for a run.
Mm-hmm.
It is also a noun, right? And you don't know until you get the context.
Mm.
The context of this G minor chord in this case is something called the cadential 6-4, which is a super nerdy word, super nerdy set of words.
I've been trying to spell it for a while.
So in music, a cadence.
Oh, okay, cool.
Cadence means, so cadence, when people talk about cadence of speech, it's like the sort of almost the music, the pace of your speech.
Also in marching bands, The quad drums play a cadence as you walk.
Is that, that's like a, the little riffs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's just saying they call that a cadence there.
Yeah.
So generally speaking in music, at least music theory, a cadence means the chords at the end of a phrase, the chords that resolve basically, right? So cadential means a chord you would use at a cadence. So in this case, it's at the end of this long section without love. We really want to drill home there. So they use this chord called the cadential 6-4. 6-4, I'll talk about later. I'll explain why it's called that. So let me just play you just that middle chord. You can hear it resolve to the 5. So the wild thing here is, you hear how that kind of wants to, they want to move?
Yeah.
One wants to move to the next one. Listen to the bass. Bass stays on the same note. This chord that wants to resolve is a G minor chord.
Yeah.
What G minor is what? What do we call it in the key? Remember? The home key, home
the
note?
The tonic?
The tonic. Yeah,
I
good.
I checked my notes.
You checked your notes? Good, you're taking notes.
I am.
Listeners, don't take notes. If you really want to know, read a book, go on YouTube. This is a G minor chord. Why does a G minor chord need to resolve? Shouldn't a G minor chord be happy where it is? So the deal here is the bass isn't on G.
And the bass is like keeping us, we want to get back to where the bass is. Like we're hearing the bass subconsciously and we want to get back there.
To, what do you mean?
To the tonic.
To the bass being on G, which is this. We want to get back there.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't that sound good? What we're getting is this. Doesn't sound quite done.
No, it's...
What's changed? Those two chords are exactly the same, except the bass is playing a different part of the chord. This chord has three members. There's a G. We call that the root.
Mm-hmm.
It's called the G chord because the G is the root. Mm-hmm. There's a middle note called the third. Called the third because it's three notes above G, right?
Is it C?
It's a B flat.
B flat. Okay. Close.
And then there's the last note, the third note on top, which we call the fifth because it's a fifth above G, which is a D.
D.
So we could either play that chord with the bass playing the G, which is called a root position G minor chord. Or we can play it with the B flat in the bass, which is the third of the chord, which we call first inversion.
Oh.
It's been inverted once. It's not third inversion because the third's in the bass. We've inverted it one time. It's confusing, I know. Either way, listen. Oh, kind of interesting. And then we can invert it again, call it second inversion, with the D in the bass, the
okay.
fifth. And that chord sort of wants to resolve. Second inversion chords are kind of unsteady.
Kind of yucky.
And so, well, you say yucky, but they're tense. I don't know if
they're
that's
tense.
Yucky.
I'm going to stand by my statement.
Okay, you're going to stand by it. Fair enough. So second inversion chords happen in certain kinds of music to give us tension. If you want to play in C major, you play a C major chord, you put C in the bass, it'll feel done. But if you put another note on the bass, especially the G, the fifth, it will sound not done.
I wonder if they know all this. I wonder if when they're writing these songs, they're like, let's add tension here by doing this specific thing. And then, or do they just have the intuition? I always come back to this.
Always. Like, we talk about intention? It all the time. And usually my answer is it doesn't matter.
I know.
In this case, my answer is 100%.
They like did it on purpose.
The bassist is choosing to not play G. Tom Johnson wrote the song. He handed the bass player the chord progression. Either Tommy Doobie. He told the bassist, I need you to play a D when I play the G chord on the guitar.
Sure.
Or the bass player when they were rehearsing the song. Because apparently this song also started as a jam.
Yeah.
Jam at a bar or whatever. Like, oh, this sounds good. Let's jam it out. And then one of the management or whatever said, turn that into a real song. So
cool.
However it started, it may have been something you wrote on a piece of paper, but probably the bassist at the time just started playing a note that wasn't the root, knowing that it would create tension that was satisfying.
Yeah.
So whether he knew the name cadential six, the cadential 6-4, folks, is a classical music theory term.
Yeah, like I'm wondering if they were at the jam band bar and they're like, you know what's going to be awesome here is a cadential 6-4.
No, but what they would have said, probably bassist would have said, you know what would be awesome here is a G minor over D.
Okay,
G minor
cool.
/ D is how you wrote it out. So those of you who are wondering why you've never seen a pop songbook with cadential 6-4 written, that's because that's not the name of a chord. That is an analytical term.
It's like language that we made up to make sense of
Correct.
Music. Yeah.
What you label it as is G minor / D. To prove my point about second inversion chords being kind of tense, you ever hear like bass parts? Think like almost like a country, especially like a classic old school country song where the bass is like boom, 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 that
yeah,
kind of sound.
Like the Muppets.
Was that the Muppets show theme song starts?
Pretty
okay.
much.
Or polka music. A lot of folk music will do this. Or marching band music, you'll have like the tubas going boom, boom, boom.
Yeah.
What's that low note? That's the fifth of the chord. They're giving us a second inversion chord to keep music moving to make it more tense, right? So it doesn't get boring when you chill on one chord. This is a style of music that uses tons of second inversion chords. Here.
Goodbye, my Coney Island baby. Farewell, my own true love.
My honey,
I'm gonna go away and leave you, never to see you any.
Never gonna see you any.
I'm gonna sail upon that.
That was the classic barbershop quartet, the Doobie Brothers.
The Doobie Brothers, the legendary. No, but that is the classic barbershop quartet, Bluegrass Student Union.
For sure.
Who won the International Barbershop Quartet competition in 1978.
Excuse me, Dude Union?
That would be so
is
cool.
That their name?
Bluegrass Student Union.
Student Union. Oh,
they don't play
man.
Bluegrass, they play barbershop. And they were among barbershop, they're one of the like the legends or whatever of that late 20th
they
century.
They would have been a lot cooler if the name was Dude Union.
Okay, all right. Yeah, I mean, that song, as a lot of barbershop, is tons of second inversion chords. So that first chord, one of the last chords, about a third of those chords are all second inversion instead of root position because it creates tension that keeps the music interesting. Certain music uses second inversion chords like this when there's tension that they want to come across. So what's the deal? Why? That's what I want to get to. And I want to, let's help appreciate this moment. Because remember, this moment is just G minor for most of the song. And then these few moments where the chords change. And this one chord is super tense, leading to the other one. Okay, you with me?
Yes.
Okay. So that second chord, what if I just put a D in there twice?
It sounds like nicer that way to me.
It's simpler. It doesn't have that weird edge of your seat sort of tension, right?
The first has like a lift to it that the simpler version doesn't.
And you like the simpler more, maybe? No, or no?
I don't know. I like the gritty lift of the first one.
Yeah.
But because
so
I'm familiar with it from the song too. So
let's figure out how this works. So what we have is a D chord, which is three notes, D, F sharp, and A. And then the G chord, we've already said, which is D on the bottom, and then G and B flat. Those notes are close together. Listen to this. That's D. That's G minor. So did you hear how I took the D chord and I just raised the upper two notes? They became a G chord. But I kept the bass the same. All you're doing is taking the upper two parts of the D chord and raising them up one step. What do they want? They want to go back down. They're unhappy there. It's kind of like if somebody took a wire and just lifted you off of your chair right now. You would very much probably want to be like by the scruff of your neck or whatever. You'd like to be put down.
Yeah,
right?
For sure.
It's that feeling. We call that in some ways, well, no. So let's take the first one, that middle note, the F sharp. We move it up to a G. So what about the upper note? Instead of going to the fifth of the D chord, it goes to the sixth. So when we put them together, we have the third of the chord going to a fourth and the fifth of the chord going to a sixth, and they really want to come down. Basically, we've got a D chord and we're pushing two of the notes too high.
Mm-hmm.
When you push those two notes too high, technically speaking, they're making a G chord. So what we're hearing here is a G technically, but it's not, it is a D with two wrong notes.
Okay.
So it looks like a G on paper, but it sounds like a D with a fancy upper suspension kind of thing, we call it. So why does this moment matter so much? It's because this song has so few chords.
Sure.
Because it's just chilling on the G forever. When we finally get a chord change, after the little blues change to the four, it gives us this juicy chord, which just makes us feel the weight of the cadence. And so that's why it's called the cadential 6-4, because it's used at the end of a phrase. And why the 6-4? Because it's a sixth and a fourth above the bass that resolves to the fifth and the third.
Yeah, it definitely adds a texture to the song that's necessary, and like it keeps you listening because you're waiting for something to happen, and when it does, it does seem really kind of powerful and meaningful because it's limited throughout the whole
changes
song.
You get are rare.
Yeah,
and so making them powerful like this makes them really impactful. Let me just give you a few other examples of this chord existing in pop songs. This is 1991, Bonnie Raitt, I Can't Make You Love Me. When she says don't patronize the second time, you're going to hear this tense chord that wants to resolve. And guess what? It's our cadential 6-4.
Don't patronize. Don't patronize me. 'Cause I can't make you love me if you don't. You can't make.
It's one of my favorite songs.
It's beautiful.
It's my, super my karaoke song.
Oh, wow. Oh, yeah. I'd like to hear that.
Well, you have to be in a different city and look for my fake name out there.
That's right. That's right. Oh, I know what it is now.
I know
what it is. The listeners know too.
Yikes.
Okay, this is 2012's Big Freeze by Muse. Listen, when he says the word collapsing, you're going to hear another cadential 6-4.
Giving David Bowie Labyrinth. vibes.
Oh, well, they're definitely going 80s for that.
I love it.
Less inappropriate package height shots probably in their music video.
Never.
All right. So last example, this is We Are Young, 2012
great
by
song.
Fun.
Yeah.
Lowercase F in Fun.
Fun, period. Or is it Fun exclamation point?
I think it's lowercase F, U, N, period.
Period. Yeah.
And the second to last chord, beautiful cadential 6-4.
Also another one of my favorite songs to sing.
Oh, yeah?
I think I'm a fan,
a sleeper fan of the cadential 6-4. Nice. So, okay, so you talked a little bit about how a chord can change in context, but what if when I tell you it's not a G chord at all, it's a D chord with wrong notes?
We try to make sense of memories and contextualize them and normalize them and find connection because it helps us feel regulated and reach what you used a word, harmonic stasis.
Right.
Right. And we talk about stasis a lot in terms of finding balance and finding homeostasis, like either balance in our nervous system or balance in our memories or finding ways to regulate ourselves. And unifying our memories to each other is a way to feel connected and to regulate yourself and to know that you're not just a speck of dust on a rock in the middle of this vast universe, right? Like it,
yeah.
We want to feel connected to each other. It's important for us as social animals. So we label our memories and we label these collective experiences just like we label chords certain things because it's easier.
Sure.
Can we talk about students and weed now?
You want to talk about students and weed? Okay. What do you want to say about weed? This is...
So
speaking of doobies, listeners.
Speaking of doobies, Mark and I are both professors. And I'm wondering, Mark, what experiences you've had with students smoking weed in your class or being high in your class or just around students and doobies.
I teach music class, so the notion that any of my students would ever use recreational drugs is absolutely ludicrous. And you could no. So everybody, we live in Massachusetts, mm-hmm. where weed is legal. Marijuana is legal for consumption by adults.
Sure is.
Yet my students, adult students, are still setting off the fire alarm smoking marijuana in the bathroom when all they have to do is walk across the street, leave campus, which they're here voluntarily for. This is not a high school. They've chosen to come here, yet still, and I don't know that it's my students, that it is my music majors, but it's not my music majors that are setting off like that. So the funniest thing for me is the way legalization has sort of not changed college campuses almost at all. Like,
yeah.
Students are still students and they still behave as if they're hiding it from their parents, which maybe some of them are hiding it from their parents, but they don't have to hide it from the cops.
No.
But they're still behaving in ways that then possibly are burning down the building.
If your intention is to hide it from your parents, smoking in a campus bathroom is not the way to do that because
correct.
You could, while it's legal in our state, it's definitely illegal federally and you could lose your federal financial aid if you get caught smoking weed on campus. Like there are repercussions that your parents would most likely learn about. I teach psychology. A lot of my psychology students make the choice to self-medicate some of their mental health concerns with marijuana and cannabis, ADHD, depression, anxiety, you know, all of these things are
yeah, I feel like being a
common.
Psychology student would cause all of that stuff.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
All that mental stress.
For sure. I've had students definitely come to class smelling like weed.
Sure. Of course. Of course. Of course.
Which is crazy to me because at this day and age, like whoever is still smoking flower and smoking actual herb from a pipe or bong or something is just there's better ways. Like we don't have to do that anymore. You can take an edible, take a vape, whatever. I've had students vape in class before.
Mm.
Not cannabis, but nicotine. Like all of a sudden there's a plume of Alice in Wonderland caterpillar smoke from the back of the room. It's like, are you vaping back there? Are you vaping in my classroom? Like, just go out, leave. Like,
yeah.
Go. I'm not kicking you out, but you don't have to.
I think that you're paying me to be here. You don't have to be here.
You don't have to.
Is a lesson that a lot of students, I think, especially younger students, really struggle to get. Like, it's rare because I I bounce around the room and I talk loud and quickly. It's rare that students fall asleep in my class.
Yeah.
But if you do, if you're that tired, I'm kind of like, why are you here?
I say that all the time. I'll monetize each class. Like every class we meet every Wednesday morning, we're in this classroom. At my school, that's like $200, $300.
Yeah, wild. Yeah.
Which is wild. You could for sure get a hotel room for that amount of money and have a much more comfortable sleep.
That's right. Yeah.
Right? Like, what are we doing? So that's my rant about, you know, students in general, about like weird behaviors in the classroom. But the weed in the classroom, man, I'll tell you what, it's hilarious. None of them know who the Doobie Brothers are, I'm sure.
Yeah. Well, they know spiritually who the Doobie Brothers are. Never Mind the Music is hosted by Nicole Vatcher and me, Mark Papany. I also produce. Please be sure to subscribe and leave us a rating and a review.
And let us know what you think on social media. We're Never Music Pod on all the major platforms. You can also send us an email at nevermusicpod@gmail.com. And every so often, we'll do a mailbag episode where we answer all your questions, so please send them in.
Thanks for listening.
Lord Vader, Operation Andor is underway.
Excellent. If we release 3 episodes per week, the Lorehounds will never be able to cover every episode. The Imperial forces will crush the rebellion before it begins.
Stand by. We're picking up something on our scanners.
Echo Squadron, reporting in.
Delta Squadron, on your left.
Django Squadron, on your 6.
With Imperial forces coming in fast, we're calling all Rebels to join the fight this season. Starting after the April 22nd premiere, you'll hear 3 full breakdowns for each week's episodes of Andor Season 2. Each podcast will be led by one of our squadron leaders, Alicia, David, and John. We'll be bringing in new and familiar voices to fill out the roster. Search for the Lorehounds on any podcast platform to join us in a galaxy far, far away. And don't forget to check out our season pass for even more content like our Holocron bonus pods. It's good news for anyone, except Darth Vader.